Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The River. This is Tom Fuller coming to you from beautiful Portland, Oregon, with my friends and your hosts, authors Maxine Marcellini and Jeannie St. John Taylor. Every Monday, Maxine and Jeannie get together to share what's on their hearts with listeners around the world. They chat with other authors and friends on a wide variety of topics. Some bring a laugh, some cause us to wipe away a tear, but all of them send rivers of blessing into our lives. These shows can be life-changing if our hearts are open and allow the river of God's love to pour into our deepest needs. So, listeners, are you ready? Now's the perfect time for me to stop talking and let the ladies take us on today's exciting journey down the river.
Listeners, welcome. This is Jeannie, and my friend and co-host is on the
Maxine.
Air with me. What's your name? There you go.
I'm Maxine. Not Mary Jo. No.
You're not. Did I say Mary Jo?
No, but if we were trying to name me that, I'm not.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. I would not name you Mary Jo. I would call you Joanne. How's that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I didn't care much for Maxine growing up, but it's kind of grown on me now, and I'm used to it.
Yeah, I kind of like it.
Just keep it there.
Yeah. I've seen it all over you, actually. I am doing great. How about you?
So far, so good. A gorgeous sunshine day here in the Pacific Northwest. What a week we're going to have.
I know. Let's enjoy it while we can have it and hope that it's still here next Monday when we come on.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this Monday, we have a really great guest for everybody, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I'm excited about our guest today.
Yeah, I know, you have been. Ever since I told you who it was like, oh, wow, okay, we've never had that topic, and it sounds really good. And did you see the pictures of Jed on the scroll that goes across for listeners to watch, his photo?
Oh, well, I won't admit to doing that, but I have been watching what's going on in the book upended, though, and the endorsers of that, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, isn't that
quite
fun?
Exciting.
Yeah. So, Jed, we are so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. It is really fun to be with you.
We just can't wait. And I want to tell our listeners who you are. You are the president of the Christian Alliance for Orphans, which is a coalition of 130 organizations that work together to inspire and equip Christians worldwide for adoption, foster care, and global orphan initiatives. But you worked for a while in the White House leading the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. I can't talk today. Community Initiatives as a special assistant to President George W. Bush. You have held a range of posts in the California State Legislature. You've worked, studied, or served in more than 30 countries, and I think you're married, right?
That's right, to the beautiful lady Rachel. And, yeah, we've got five kids, too.
Five. Hey, now, are those adopted or biological or a little bit of both?
Four biological, one adopted. The one in the middle, our precious little Eden, is adopted.
Oh,
what
from
a beautiful
where?
Name.
I know, I love
She's from Ethiopia originally.
Oh. Oh. Wow, I love that. Jed, you know, in the one photograph, I don't know if you saw, but off the web, I snatched the picture of you stretched across the top of about, I think there's like five guys beneath you between two rocks. Or,
oh, my goodness.
Tell us about that.
Picture from my college days.
Oh, were you in college then? You certainly looked energetic, I will say that. So that was fun.
Good deal. Oh, yeah. Good memories for sure.
So how long have you held the position of president of the Christian Alliance for Orphans?
So for more than 4 years now. I've
just
felt really privileged to get to work with these organizations that are, you know, each of the member organizations of the Christian Alliance for Orphans are doing their own great work in adoption and foster care and globally, but working together through the Alliance, just really with a united voice, trying to inspire and equip Christians for the work.
What a great service. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, Jed, let's get started with some questions here. You refer to North American Christians as rather predictable people. And I think that puts Maxine and I in there, too. I don't know. Why do you say that about them?
Well, you know, and this includes all of us, myself included,
yeah.
And it's not entirely bad. I mean, you know, the reality is that in many ways, if you look at your average American person and then you go next door to your average Christian person, you're going to see very, very similar demographics, very similar choices, you know, the same soccer leagues, the same evening activities. And that, again, not all of that is bad by any stretch. Many of these things are just neutral or even good. But ultimately, mm-hmm. For those who are going to be true disciples, true apprentices to Jesus, we would think life would look a bit more different. It would be upended, turned upside down, reversed in ways that might be a little more surprising and shocking than your average Christian pew sitter.
Hmm. You know, I've noticed that a lot of times non-Christians are just as nice as Christians and just as considered. And it seems to me, not that they shouldn't be, and it's wonderful that they are, but it seems to me that Christians should kind of outdo them in niceness and in contentedness, don't you think?
I think so. I definitely think mm-hmm. so. But I think we would also want to, you know, I mean, of course, there's so many layers to this question, and, you know,
yeah.
But ultimately, I think what we're trying to explore in the book is this idea that when Christ calls us to follow him, you know, it's certainly not just a ticket into heaven. It's not, it is indeed about eternity, but it's also about today. There are so many implications of what he invites us to. And for my co-author Eric and I, that's really what we're discovering is what are the small choices that we make each day that either turn us towards Christ and cause us to reflect his vibrancy, his character more and more in our daily, ordinary lives, or perhaps turn away from that.
Yeah, you got making a good point there, Jed. And
yeah.
We really should mention that Jed Medefend has a co-author named Eric Locasmo. Did I say that correct?
Very close, Locasmo, yes.
Locasmo. Okay, and your book is called Upended, How Following Jesus Remakes Your World, Your Words and World. So, and you know what, I have found that to be true in my walk with Christ, because the more I know him, the more I have changed my words and my concept of what I'm to be doing in this world. So why do so many of our Christians have a vague sense of disconnection then to Christ? If we're calling ourselves Christians, what is the problem?
Well, you know, that idea of the sense of disconnect, you know, I think it's something that everyone feels today. You know, we're more connected technologically than ever before. At any moment, you know, we literally could, in some way, connect to a person just about any place in the world, and yet we sense this vague sense of disconnect, relationally dissatisfaction, and what we're exploring in this book is the question: by following Jesus as true apprentices, in really beginning to make choices like he did in the ways that he interacted with people, might that be the antidote to this deep sense of disconnect? And again, I'd want to be clear, we can talk about this more. It's not about, you know, tips and techniques to make friends and influence people. This is about living as a real apprentice to Jesus in a way that ultimately allows us to connect more deeply with others, to leave a lasting impact in their life in a way that very little in this world ever does.
Yeah, I know. That's what I pray for, Jed, for myself and for my children and for my grandchildren now. You have a chapter entitled The Rarest Commodity in America. What is that?
Right. What is that? Is it oil? Is it gold? Is it platinum?
Yeah.
what we believe the rarest commodity of all in America is just basic attentiveness of really get ourselves wholeheartedly to that one person in front of us in a given moment, to give the gift of presence, as we describe it in the book, that all of us, you know, our attention is so fractionalized, pulled in so many different directions by the text message, the email, the billboard, the thought of what we've just done or what we're going to do. And yet one of the first things that we begin to do if we are going to follow Jesus as a true apprentice to him is begin to follow him in the practice of presence, of giving ourselves fully to that person in front of us.
How would you suggest we do that? Did you see the thing on the news last week about there's a man on a bus, I think it was in New York, who was waving a gun around his head, and then he ended up shooting somebody. He even used the gun to wipe, to scratch his face, I think. He was sitting 2 feet from people all around him, and nobody noticed it, and eventually he shot and I think killed one of the people. How do you stop the because they were looking at their cell phones?
Well, they were plugged into their cell phones and stuff,
yes,
weren't they? Yeah, it was a crazy
yes, they
story.
Were.
I had not heard that story.
About.
But what a tragic emblem, you know, of what we're talking about here. People just completely unaware of the person sitting right next to them, right across from them. And what I would see that particular story as is that is the kind of the final end, the ultimate fruit of a culture that long, long before that, this individual, this man, almost certainly had no one to pay close attention to him at home in basic friendships. You know, by the time he's on a bus waving a gun around, it's probably too late. It might be too late. But had there been a teacher who really would take special interest in him, you know, at home, had there been, perhaps he was in foster care, had there been a family willing to foster him or perhaps mentor him and really listen well, that's of course what we're talking about. There's actually some data of young women who are living as prostitutes in San Francisco, and a study kind of examined what it was that they were lacking at home that caused them to run away from home. These were runaways who were on the streets of San Francisco as prostitutes now, and almost every single one of them, the thread came back to a single phrase: "What I didn't have at home was someone to listen to me." And I think that's, you know, epidemic from the basement of society to its glittering top. The wealthy and powerful feel the same. There is just this absolute lack of true attentiveness in our culture. And when Christians choose to follow Jesus in that, when we really give ourselves to the person in front of us, that's a radical thing. It's deeply countercultural.
So what exactly is this ministry of listening that you are referring to in your book?
Well, you know, one story that really just deeply impacted my co-author and I, it was one that, of course, we'd grown up hearing, but rereading it through this lens was, Jesus had landed on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. A big crowd gathered around, and an influential man came up and said, "Jesus, my daughter is dying. Come with me to heal her. Will you come?" And of course, Jesus agreed. And so this huge crowd set out, and there was all this urgency and noise and busyness, and it just, you know, I think felt a lot like our lives feel today, just so full, so noisy, so urgent. And in the middle of all that, the scripture described that Jesus said, "Who touched me?" He stopped, and he waited until this one marginalized woman fell out of the crowd in front of him and said, you know, she confessed, "It was me who touched you." This woman who had this bleeding disease, and what's amazing to me is that the Gospels describe that the moment she touched Jesus, she received the physical healing that she thought she had come for. She was already well, and yet Jesus still paused, and the Gospel describes that she told him her whole story, that she described the 12 years of her bleeding disease and the doctors who had taken her money, and probably talked about the way it felt to not be able to go into the temple and worship because of her uncleanness, all these things. And only at the end of that did Jesus say, "Daughter, go in peace. Your faith has made you well." And, you know, that what blew me away there is the shocking premium that Jesus placed on listening to this woman, on being attentive to her, when there was this hugely urgent situation of a dying little girl elsewhere. There was a crowd around, and yet he gave himself wholly to this one woman. Man, when we choose to do the same amidst our busy, noisy, urgent lives, it gives a gift that is so incredibly rare today.
Yeah, that's
Jed,
beautiful.
I wonder how what you're saying about presence and about being in the lives of people, I wonder how that is connected to orphans and your job and your love of orphans and foster children?
You know, that's a great question. And I would say that, you know, one of the biggest things, as I spend time with kids both in the U.S. and foster care and in other parts of the world as well, I see that, you know, what they yearn for more than anything else is a loving adult to take an interest in their lives. And the number one that way that is conveyed, I think, is by listening, by asking questions, by spending time with them, but just being present in their lives. And, of course, that, you know, ideally happens through a mom and a dad. That's why adoption is such a powerful thing, that it in a sense provides that on a permanent basis. But even when that's not possible, I was actually just last week in Ukraine and with a few people who would every week go into a local orphanage. They came from a local church there and would spend time with the kids there. And, man, when we came up to this orphanage, I saw these children just running out. Some of them were junior high age boys. Just wrapping these you know, not very impressive adults, but wrapping them in big hugs. They were just so excited to see it. And the reality is, you know, this ragtag group of four Ukrainian Christians that came every week, they were just showing a consistent presence in these kids' lives. And, man, even that can make such a powerful difference.
Gave them a relationship that they knew was somehow stable that would come back next week probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. How difficult is it for the adoption process to go through with the international children?
It really is challenging at this point, and there's a lot of layers to that, a lot of reasons for it. But inter-country adoption has become very constricted, and so even though there's more Christian families than ever in the U.S. And in other parts of the world too, who are willing to adopt, and of course millions of children right now that are growing up without families, that kind of that slender connection between the two of them, inter-country adoption, has become very constricted. And so it's still happening, and it's still kids finding loving families, but it's very constricted. And so that points us to other ways of seeking to love these children, whether that's through supporting in-country efforts to care for kids, mentoring and adoption programs within their home countries, as well as serving locally here, getting involved in foster care and foster to adopt and mentoring within our own home communities also.
Okay. So there are quite a bunch of children available in this country, I mean, through the foster system in particular, but are there many of them that have their parental rights severed enough to where adoption is possible there?
Yes, well, there's about 400,000 children in foster care at any point, and about a quarter of them, about 100,000 right now, need permanent families. And, you know, the majority of those children are older. They're not infants. They're 4, 5, 6, 10, 12 years old. They're in this situation through no fault of their own. It was, you know, neglect or abuse that put them in the spot, and so they're innocent victims of these things, and they desperately need families, and it's not something to be undertaken lightly. You know, even though they're precious children, they carry wounds from the experiences they've had, and so loving them and nurturing them, healing them can carry challenges. But man, what a beautiful reflection of God's heart, a beautiful reflection of the way in which God has loved us, whether we're choosing to adopt, whether we're mentoring, whether we're fostering and hoping that we can reunite that child with their birth parents. These are all expressions of God's heart and his deep love for the child that lacks parents.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed, Jed, that you and Eric have an endorsement from West Stafford from Compassion. I've got four Compassion children, three Compassion children and one with World Vision that I support, but none of those are orphan children. But they still need the support, and I've noticed you've got these people endorsing what you're doing with the Alliance for Orphans. Are they considered kind of like an orphan when they don't have the means to have their studies and their care met?
Absolutely. You know, the biblical idea isn't as strict as your dictionary definition. You know, the dictionary or the UNICEF definition of an orphan is a child who has lost one or both parents, usually. And whereas the biblical idea is of a child who is lacking the provision and protection that parents uniquely provide. And in some cases, you know, those are children that have lost both parents or perhaps have been abandoned by their parents, and so they are in need of new parents through adoption. But in many cases, it's a child, for instance, maybe the father has died or has left, and they're with their widowed mother. and they desperately need the support of on a financial level, but perhaps in other ways as well, and compassion and organizations that are serving children in vulnerable situations like that, or, you know, I see them as very much a reflection of God's deep love for these children, even if the children are not, you know, technically without both parents.
Okay, good answer. Good answer.
That is good. This is great. Hey, we are talking, listeners, to Jed Metafend, who has written a book called Upended, How Following Jesus Remakes Your World and Your Words, or the other way around, words and world. Hey, speaking of words, could you talk to us about authenticity? And it's a buzzword in our society. What do you think about that? And how do we live it? Or should we live it?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's definitely a buzzword. I mean, you can't watch, a daytime talk show without, you know, the host and without the guests, you know, talking about how authentic they are, or how authentic they want to be, or authenticity. And you have your reality TV shows. And yet I think all of this talk of authenticity really is just a testament to the fact that it's so absent in our culture today. And people are hungry for it, desperately hungry for it, I think, often. And I think that often, even as Christians, we don't offer much better than that same kind of painted-on smile that the rest of the culture offers, the kind of the marketing of things that sees our faith, that sees even our own lives as something that we kind of carefully market and manage through everything from a grin at church to the way that we present ourselves on Facebook or other things. And, you know, what? It's just really interesting to look at the way that Jesus offered himself to those around him, that he made himself so very exposed to them, so very present in their lives. Even, you know, when he was really what we would call just deeply sorrowful at the tomb of Lazarus or in the Garden of Gethsemane, you saw both the sorrow as well as in times of celebration. Those things came through in a way that very, very few leaders today, or any of us for that matter, are willing to offer ourselves. And so, you know, what my co-author and I really, really expressed was just this idea that when we begin to reflect Jesus in that, when we communicate, kind of like the psalmist continually did, through sharing deeply of both the joys and the heartaches of life, of our pursuit of God, of the experiences around us, when we share ourselves with that kind of authenticity, once again, it really upends the expectations that others have. It's surprising, it's unexpected, it's difficult, but it is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things did Jesus do to upend the period of time when he was walking on this earth? Because he did things that weren't quite what was expected in the norm. What did he do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, in many ways, the whole book is an exploration of that. And one of the most significant points for me, and honestly, this just continues to impact the way I see things, is that many of these choices were not these huge life choices. It's, you know, it's a lot of times we think of what are the biggest choices we'll make, and we think of that being, you know, whom we'll marry and what job we'll take, what city we'll live in, and those are indeed big decisions. But my co-author Eric and I really have pondered is the fact that so often it's the small daily choices that most shape our lives. And so you begin to think about the way that Jesus, for instance, approached asking questions. You know, here he was, the way, the truth, and the life. He had the answers to life, despite big questions. And yet the Gospels record more than 150 questions that Jesus asked. And we see that as just one small example of the ways that he upended the normal ways of doing things. Even today, leaders lead with exclamation points. Jesus so often led with the question mark. And if we choose to follow him in that with the small daily choices of asking good questions of the people around us, really putting thought into the types of questions we ask, that is one small way of apprenticing to him and really living countercultural lives.
Hmm. You're making a very important point. What is the advantage of asking with questions rather than just statements with an exclamation point behind them?
Yeah,
how does the one listening take that in?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we've all experienced it. When someone has come at us with a new idea and they've got at the end of their statement a big exclamation point, we just so often put our shield up, don't we? We feel defensive. We've got our armor up, and we've got our sword and our shield, and we're ready to do battle. But when someone comes at us with a question mark, we could call it the humble bent over exclamation point. It's an invitation, and our shield and our sword just don't have any place there. So we set them down, and if we sense that the other person is not just asking a rhetorical question, but really is interested in knowing what we think about it, really wants to probe this together, we put our shield down and we begin to interact with it. And so, you know, the question mark comes with an invitation to discovery. And Jesus was continually doing that, saying, who do you say that I am? Or who is this man's neighbor? Or what were you arguing about along the road? And I think that's just such a great way to show others love and invite them on a process of exploration. It's ultimately far more powerful than the exclamation point ever would be.
Yeah, it's open and inviting, and I can see how that would work because you're expressing value in what they might say after you ask the question.
Yes, and that's the key point. I mean, the question mark ultimately shifts the focus from ourselves to the other person, and that's kind of the center point of love, isn't it? Just to not continually put the spotlight on ourselves, not continually be trying to say what we think or what we want others to believe, but instead turning that spotlight back to the other and saying, what you think matters, what you feel matters to me, and I want to hear about it. I'm going to take the time, be attentive enough to really listen.
You know, when I was getting my master's degree, I went through a lot of courses that kind of taught this same thing. You know, they call it reflexive listening. But isn't that a little different than this? I mean, can you just paste this on? Because I think you can just paste that on. Can you paste this on, or you have to have something different inside you to do this authentically?
I love that question. That is huge. And I totally agree with where you're going. But, you know, if we just want to pick up some tips and techniques to make others like us or to be more influential, then, yeah, we can paste on some reflexive listening. We can learn some little skills to make others think that we're attending to them. But ultimately, you know, it becomes sometimes wearisome to listen well. We are very busy. We've got to get to our next thing. You know, there's 101 reasons not to continue to attend well to others in the radical, sacrificial way that Jesus did. And I think that only comes from the sense of our Heavenly Father that Jesus gave us. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the Bible continually describes God the Father as attentive to our prayers, that he is near to us, that he is attentive to us. And then we look at Jesus, his physical manifestation on earth, and he was so attentive to children and to the tax collector up in the tree and to blind Bartimaeus and to the bleeding woman. And we realize the one we are following was attentive while on earth, and he is now attentive to our prayers. And it's only when we're really dwelling with a deep sense of that that we can go out and really begin to show that deep sacrificial attentiveness that you're talking about, I think.
Thank you. And Jed, we are just almost out of time. We've actually gone just a little bit longer than we should. Maxine, do you have one more thing you want to say to the author of How Upended, How Following Jesus Remakes Your Words and Your World?
Well, I just want to have him tell our listeners, perhaps, where people can get a hold of this book or a hold of him, and what is the one thing that you'd leave our listeners with that allows them to get involved in the lives of the orphans?
Well, you know, for being up in the Northwest, where you are, the Portland area, actually EmbraceOregon.org is a great organization that's getting churches and individual Christians involved in caring for kids in the local system and their families. So I would really encourage locally Embrace Oregon. And then nationally, the Christian Alliance for Orphans is there to really help people to get involved and engage well. And then the book Upended is you can get it at Amazon and a lot of Christian bookstores, or we also have a little website, upended.org.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And, Jed, we've loved talking with you. You know our listeners have
you too. Both of you. Thank you.
This is Tom Fuller saying thank you for joining us on The River today. I pray blessings have come your way. Please check out our hosts' websites to learn a little more about them. Maxine Marcellini is the author of Rebuilding Families $1 at a Time, Blended Families, and Raising Children in Blended Families. She's a life coach whose website, rebuildingfamilies.net, is full of family helps and resources. Jeannie St. John Taylor is the author and illustrator of more than 25 books for adults as well as children. You'll find her books plus a link to read her newest biblical fiction, City of a Thousand Gods, on her website at jeanniestjohntaylor.com. All our programs are archived for later listening enjoyment. Consider posting a comment after today's show. And please let your friends know about what's happening at the river. Most of all, remember, you are never alone in this river called life. Jesus is with you and only a prayer away.